Hello, I'm Andrew Tuck and you're listening to The Urbanist on Monocle 24, the show all about the cities we live in. In this episode, it's our best of 2016. Well, at least what we could fit into a one-hour show. We've looked back over the past 12 months to fish out some of the most colourful, fascinating and interesting moments here on The Urbanist. From Rio de Janeiro's Olympic urban legacy to one of Sydney's most unusual social housing estates. And even climb a tree or two.
Give me that foot. And on there.
Cool.
Just, you know, really tune in to that inner gibbon.
Plus chats with Carl Weisbrod, chairman of New York City Planning Commission, and Jennifer Keysmat, chief planner of Toronto.
Invisible City is about trying to help youth see the relevance of city building and city planning.
Stay tuned as we unwrap the year that was on The Urbanist, right here on Monocle 24. We start this look back on The Urbanist in Turkey. In February, we did a special episode with a cinema show here on Monocle 24 to explore the ways in which cities are portrayed on the screen. On the surface, Istanbul seems like a city of soaring minarets, Byzantine beauty and grandiose views. But underneath is a much grittier city, where intrigue and espionage has often lurked behind its ornate facades. This is the face that often shines brightest when the camera is on, and our bureau chief in the city, Christopher Lord, gave us his take on why this old den of spies still looks good on film.
If Istanbul were an actor, it would be of a very particular sort. The Brando type, no doubt handsome, plenty of wit and character, but with lines in its face and a subdued gloom that means only certain roles make sense. There's a brief scene in From Russia with Love, with James Bond aboard a ferry crossing the Bosphorus, that sums this up perfectly. Bond and his Russian defector femme fatale, Tatiana, are pretending to be tourists so they can discreetly record her description of a Soviet code-breaking machine and send the tape back to MI6. Bond's boxy camera conceals a voice recorder, while the early 60s grain of the film gives the Bosphorus a startling blue hue. In the backdrop is this endless rolling strip of carved mosques, wooden neighbourhoods and grey-suited commuters passing by.
About the machine.
That's all you are interested in. Not me.
The business first.
I know. Once you have got what you want.
I haven't got it yet. But if you tell me about the machine, well, afterwards we won't always be working on the company's time.
All right. What do you want to know?
Talking to this. Answer my questions quietly, but clearly.
This scene is important for a few reasons. It's an early depiction of a very modern Istanbul on film. One of the stipulations to allow shooting on location was that Turks would only be shown in modern attire. So that's no fezes, no belly dancers. Bond's grey suit and navy tie, therefore, fit in perfectly. Take a stroll through the back streets of Beyoğlu, past the 19th century consulates, the shadowy din of the city's seedier bars, and from the ground up you can feel why Ian Fleming, Eric Ambler, even Agatha Christie's Orient Express found this city a fitting locale for a little literary skullduggery. It's got crammed in streets that are baroque but not picturesque, where grand old buildings are left to rot and gloomy passages rattle with the sound of closing shutters. All this, of course, translates perfectly on screen and was what directors hooked when they moved the focus of John le Carré's Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy from Hong Kong to old Istanbul for the remake in 2011. To nervously type codes in an Istanbul hotel room somehow makes perfect sense.
Tell me.
He killed our man in Istanbul.
It has become so ugly.
We've been the only thing standing between Moscow and the Third World War.
Now's the time.
But there's one thing that also makes Istanbul an eternal centre of intrigue. It's what occupied Vienna, Berlin, and even Beirut had in their heyday as dens of spies. And it comes back again to that ferry scene. A great city for espionage is inherently divided. Whether that was the Iron Curtain as a cover for Stasi subterfuge in Cold War Berlin, or the Bosphorus that carves Istanbul into two continents. Anywhere there are divides in a city, barriers and interstitial spaces, there is a vacuum where intrigue and shadowy meetings can take place. That's what Istanbul latently captures on film. Ian Fleming perhaps says it best. From the first, Istanbul had given him the impression of a town where, with the night, horror creeps out of the stones.
That was Monocle's Man in the Shadows, the Istanbul bureau chief, Christopher Lord. Now, this is perhaps one of our favourite reports here on The Urbanist from this year. In a sunny afternoon back in April, we dispatched Monocle's Bill Luty for a more, let's say, unusual report. He joined Jack Cook, author of the book The Tree Climber's Guide, to experience firsthand the liberating experience of urban tree climbing, the urge to release our inner gibbon and explore the world above.
All right, I saw one groundskeeper on the edge there. Once we're up in the tree, though, we're completely invisible. That's the joy of climbing trees, is you become almost omnipotent. You can see everything, but no one can see you, because no one ever looks up. But on one occasion, I was stopped by the police in Brompton Cemetery when a woman rang up the local police station to tell them a young man was about to commit suicide. So they came screaming through the gate, thinking they were going to find a body swinging from a branch, and they were very relieved that they didn't, so they let me off. But, you know, some of the rules are quite ambiguous. I think we never bat an eyelid if it's a child in a tree, but as soon as someone sees an adult, they're deeply suspicious. They assume there's an ulterior motive at play.
So we've got a few pines here.
They're called Monterey pines. They're originally from California and Mexico, but they're planted all over the world, mostly for their timber. In fact, a lot of them are used as telegraph poles, amongst other things. They're a long way from home, but as you can see, growing strong under the care of the local groundskeepers. So this is Houdini's door from the book, so nicknamed because it is a vanishing act, a sort of magic trick above London when you get into the top.
Okay.
And here we have it.
That's it. It's beautiful. So, shoes off.
Absolutely.
And I've got socks on.
You know, I think it's worth the odd stub toe and splinter. It's a much more immersive experience climbing in bare feet. So, also this tree, being a pine, you get some good sap on your feet, which will help you stick to the branch.
Any tips for techniques?
I think always try and keep 4 points of contact as much as possible. Uh-huh. So, you know, make sure you've got a different branch for both feet and both hands. And stay close to the trunk as well. The trunk is an amazing sort of safety, a mast to cling to. And if you do slip and you're close to the trunk, you'll manage to latch on. So it's always a bit of a heave to get up onto the first branch, the lowest. It's usually the beginning of the tree is the hardest bit. So with this tree, it's almost as if it was made to be climbed. They grow in a kind of corkscrew around the trunk. So sometimes you feel like you're following a staircase up the tree. So we'll do exactly that. We'll move around this way.
Okay. We're already about, 10 feet up?
Yeah, I'd say we've just passed Britain's tallest man below us. So I think we're going to try and step up into here. You could try going up there. So if you go around there and put a left foot up into that.
Not quite as flexible as you.
There we go. And on up.
Okay.
Oh, you're a natural.
Thank you. Did you hear that, Mum?
I think it's Bill of the Jungle.
Maybe I shouldn't think about how high up we are.
Don't worry, you've got plenty of insurance. I mean, not actual insurance, obviously. No one's going to pay when you fall out the tree.
I've got death in service.
Yes. There's lots of medals to be won for this. No, you're fine. We'll go come around here. Try and come up through those branches and get a foot in here, which is a nice big patch.
Get a knee in.
Knee. There's no dignity in climbing trees. You can always go up on your knees. So maybe step over that one a bit. It's a bit like a turnstile. Imagine you're getting onto the tube in the morning. There you go. So, yeah, come over there. Now you're as secure as you could be. See, we're starting to get some views of various construction sites and the glorious BT Tower.
Of course.
The old revolving restaurant. Don't look down. I'm going to take a picture of your feet, which are looking incredibly handsome.
Thank you.
So how are you feeling?
Yeah, fine.
We're actually very nearly at the top. And a dog walker is passing beneath us. Mm-hmm. Dogs are always very suspicious. They see tree climbers as oversized squirrels. So I was thinking you might just get a leg over here or step up on the one, this one here, but with your left foot. So get your left foot up onto this one.
Okay.
And then your right leg hopefully can come over the one I'm sitting on.
Thank you.
And you're just getting up amongst the pine cones now. You can see 1,000 pine cones ringing the branches. So every single one of those scales is potentially another pine tree.
I think by now, if I wasn't trying to be brave for the radio, I'd have stopped.
It's amazing what peer pressure and media can do. You're already a good 30 feet above London. Oh, the amount of... This was a terrible mistake. The amount of pigeon poo. Very dead branch.
Dead now.
You're actually doing the favour to a tree by taking away a little bit of dead wood, but okay. Mind you don't drop it on anyone's head.
Thanks.
Watch out for that, and just get your bum up onto there, and you're there.
We're done.
There's your view.
Whoa.
So was it worth it for the view?
Okay, so it's a little window. We haven't come up to a panorama.
It's sort of perfectly framed. It's a bit like someone's, been to the framers with central London and shoved it in a gilt pine needle frame.
Yeah. And the temptation is to take a photo.
Always tempting. I'd advise people to take lots of photos, but remember to enjoy it as well. I think there's a bit of a problem these days with the camera becoming the moment. We take so many pictures that we actually forget what we were doing in the first place. I'm certainly taking one of you covered in pigeon poo.
I'm covered in shit.
Yeah, but in a good way. I think that the joy of climbing trees in the middle of the city and in the middle of a sort of 9 till 5 is just the escape. You know, it really breaks up the working day and takes you 5 minutes to get up here. But you've travelled a lot further. Most of us are tied in to getting the same bus to work, eating the same sandwich, going through the same inbox in the morning. And, you know, just spending 5 minutes in a tree makes a day a lot more memorable. And the more you come back to different trees, the more they become personal landmarks. You know, they become old favourites, and watching them change through the seasons is fascinating. You know, it's observing nature in the sort of microscopic detail as well. Because you come up, the branch we're sitting on right now, I suppose we're hanging about 30 foot above the park. You know, how many people have been up here and seen the life that's living in the tree? And actually, once I'd spent enough time in trees, I felt I didn't really want to hang around on ground level all the time. It became increasingly hard to hold down my day job, a bit distracted. But walking around London, I now look all the time, whether I'm on a street or in a park or a garden or going along a canal or river, I'm always looking around for a climbable tree. And, you know, it's given me a new appreciation of the trees themselves.
Your obsession.
Yeah.
Have you ever met anyone up at the top?
Yeah, a few people. I mean, mostly children in trees, which is a shame, because I do feel adults should get the same joy out of climbing and have the same relationship to nature. But I have famously met a lawyer in an ash tree who was with his jacket hanging on a branch. He said it was his regular lunch spot. You know, he's working in the heart of central London, and every day he'd just take off his jacket and tie, shoot up this ash tree. It wasn't a particularly special tree. Sit out on a branch and have his sandwich. You know, what better way to get a bit of light relief?
Why do you think we're so obsessed with them? Why are they so magical?
You know, London and many cities around the world have some great planting schemes that have been here for many years. A lot of the trees in this park would have been planted by the Victorians. So we've got 150-year-plus rooted trees in the park. So they are majestic. And, of course, there's much older ones across the city. If you go over to Greenwich Park, there's some sweet chestnuts that are 500-600 years old, certainly too venerable to be climbed. I'd stay away from the old giants and leave them in happy retirement. And I think by climbing, it's a more visceral contact. I mean, it's all very well reading a textbook about this pine tree, but I bet you it wouldn't stick in your mind as long as now you're hanging in it 30 feet off the ground. So yeah, it's a kind of primal interaction, and I think it's something that it'd be a great shame if it, you know, due to a risk-averse culture and an increasing reliance on our handheld phones and computers, it'd be a great shame if we gave up climbing trees, because we learn so much from doing it.
That was Bill Luty talking to Jack Cook at the top of a tree. Back in June, we brought you a special episode from the Academy of Urbanism's 10th Anniversary Congress here in London. One of the cities in focus was Toronto, which has seen a dramatic transformation over the past few years, from revamping old and forgotten areas to rebuilding with people and community in mind. Much of this work is down to the guidance of one woman, Jennifer Keesmaat, the chief planner for the City of Toronto.
Well, it's not something that happens on a dime, of course. It's an ongoing exercise to essentially build a whole series of constituencies for really progressive design ideas. I think it's something that never stops. We, in fact, have an initiative called Growing Conversations, which is sort of a lovely double entendre, but the notion is that the conversation about our city and what we are becoming is something that constantly needs to be growing and evolving as a city is growing and evolving. So it's actually very difficult. It's not easy, and it's something that you have to be tenacious about because you never get to that point where it's complete. It's a continuous exercise.
One of the things you talked about was engaging with the audience who are like 16 to 34, who are the future of most cities and are important and vital. How have you done this?
Well, there's a whole variety of ways that we've done this. We created a youth research team. So we actually brought in youth to go out and engage with youth in the city, youth-to-youth engagement, instead of, you know, a bunch of bureaucrats trying to get youth interested in our process. We created something called PIPS, which stands for Planners in Public Space, where we go to events and festivals and public spaces where youth are, and we engage with youth on site, recognizing that the odds of young people showing up for a public meeting from 7 to 9 in the evening is simply not going to happen. And launching Invisible City as a podcast was another way of using an unconventional means to engage youth and to draw them into the planning process. And really, Invisible City is about trying to help youth see the relevance of city building and city planning. Our youth research team really revealed to us that one of our biggest challenges is most young people don't actually see government as being relevant. They don't see the connection between the work that's being done in City Hall and their everyday lives. And of course, the connection is profound. So our job is to figure out how to connect those dots.
That was Jennifer Keysmat, Chief Planner for the City of Toronto. June was a month filled with urbanism conferences and debates, including ReSite, a two-day summit set in Prague, aimed to tackle one of the biggest challenges for modern cities, migration. We spoke with experts, policymakers and more to understand how cities across Central Europe and beyond were standing up to the test. But for this particular item, we head over to New York, where affordable housing has been one of the top priorities for Carl Weisbrod, the chairman of New York's City Planning Commission. And for a city with more than 3 million foreign-born citizens, this is not an easy task to have on your desk.
The challenge of affordable housing in New York is largely a product of the success of New York in attracting people from around the world and across the United States. And this has really been part of New York's DNA since its birth, really, 400 years ago. So we face an enormous housing crisis in New York, a housing crisis generally, but particularly an affordable housing crisis, where the gap between the number of apartments that are very poor and poor households can afford and the ones that are available is about 500,000 apartments. So we have an enormous gap to make up. So, and Mayor de Blasio has really emphasize the importance of narrowing the gap between rich and poor. New York is extremely successful right now, but as with most of the world, the rich are getting richer, and the poor and middle class are at best holding their own, or in many cases getting poorer. And for them, the housing crisis is particularly acute. So we are investing $8 billion in city money over the next 10 years just to build affordable housing, and matching that with a variety of land use strategies, zoning strategies, neighborhood strategies, all designed to build and preserve 200,000 units of affordable housing over 10 years. We're 2 years into our plan now. We're right on target. We have created 40,000 units in the first 2 years. And we're well on course to achieve the mayor's goal, which is very ambitious. And I'll just say that our affordable housing plan devotes more resources than the next 50 cities in the United States combined. And our zoning approaches, which include a requirement for mandatory inclusionary zoning whenever we increase housing capacity in an area, is certainly the most rigorous in the United States.
You were talking about the plan, which is a very ambitious plan, as you say. How do you see
other, like, of course, it's going to, if it all goes according to plan, it will narrow that gap that you and the mayor are trying to make sure it happens. But what are some of the other consequences that you're hoping to achieve with this initiative?
Well, I think that housing is the number one social need and societal requirement for a family living in any place, to have a roof and a safe roof and a secure home environment is critical, not just to simply providing housing, but to achieve success in life, particularly for children growing up in poverty or with limited resources. One of the things we hope to achieve through our program is increased economic diversity in our neighborhoods. The evidence, social evidence, is pretty strong that poor children who grow up in economically diverse neighborhoods do a lot better in life than poor children who just grow up in poor neighborhoods. And so increasing our economic diversity, as we've increased both our demographic diversity and our economic diversity, are really important goals for us.
That was Carl Weisbrod, the chairman of New York City Planning Commission, speaking to Monocle's Carlotta Rebello. But perhaps one of the most scrutinised cities this year was Rio de Janeiro, with the world questioning if it would be able to pull off the Olympic Games. Just 1 week before the opening ceremony, we broadcast a special episode on Rio's Olympic urban legacy. Here's Ashina Roster with a highlight.
Rio de Janeiro really sold its Olympic bid based on its sister city, Barcelona, which hosted the Games back in 1992 and was one of the few successful and profitable Games. In fact, Rio's bid book even quotes former Barcelona mayor, Pasqual Maragall. There's two types of Olympic Games, a city that serves the Games and a Games that serves the city, says former mayor Barcelona. And Rio is hoping to be in the latter category, or at least that's what organizers have been saying. But as political corruption scandals have plagued the image of these Olympic legacy projects that were in the city's bid book, it raises the question, who is it really all for? Here's Christopher Gaffney, a senior researcher for the University of Zurich who has extensively studied Rio's shifting urban landscape, to explain more.
What we've seen is this explicit state policy of gentrifying the landscape, both landscapes that are already there or future landscapes. And so the Olympic Park or the Olympic Village called Ilha Pura says all you need to know. Ilha Pura, pure island, says all you need to know about the idea of the city that is being promoted. And so a pure island wants to say that the city is polluted in some way, that the city is to be escaped, not only socially but physically and symbolically. And so this symbolic pureness has come about as a result of a 2.33 billion real loan from Caixa Econômica Federal, one of the federal banks. And this has benefited the developers, who can sell these apartments on the open market. And if the developments fail and the developers can't pay back that loan, the state is on the hook for it, or let's say the public is on the hook for this. And so this is a very explicit project of gentrifying certain high-value territories or trying to extract more money out of those territories, while at the same time pushing the poor people that used to live around those places further and further out. In order to get those people back to their places of employment, they build very substandard transportation lines like the BRT. And so transportation, real estate speculation, gentrification, and the Olympics all go together, and they all work in conjunction to create a much less equal city.
One of the most highly publicized examples of a local community being pushed out because of Rio 2016 Olympic development is the case of Vila Autodromo. Perched on the fringes of the Olympic Park in Rio de Janeiro's West Zone, Vila Autodromo was a low-income community where roughly 700 families used to live, and where about 600 were forcibly removed and relocated to Parque Carioca, a subsidized housing complex located even further west in the city. Donna Maria da Peña, a petite 50-year-old with short salt-and-pepper hair, is among the residents of about 20 families in total here in Villa Autodromo who refuse to leave despite the orders from the city. Calm in her demeanor, but with a firm, raspy voice, she has become the leader of this movement to remain in Villa Autodromo. She tells me that she's lived in this community for most of her life, and that no one builds a home imagining it would be torn down. After a long standoff between herself and Mayor Eduardo Paes, her home was ultimately torn down, and she was left to sleep in a local church with her family. It was only after she garnered a large amount of media attention at home and abroad that City Hall then backpedaled and offered to build homes for families that wanted to remain. New homes are now slowly going up in Villa Autodromo as the games inch closer. And as Donna Peña tells me, she's waiting for Mayor Eduardo Paes to deliver her new home, something that she has to trust his word on. Stories like Donna Peña's is just one example of forced evictions in the city since Rio won the right to host the Olympics. According to official data from the city gathered in a dossier, a total of 22,059 families were evicted between 2009 and 2015. Totaling 75,206 people who were forcibly evicted in the lead-up to the games. Christopher Gaffney, again.
What I would call state-sponsored terrorism to forcibly remove people from their homes. And this has repeated itself all over the city. In Rio, we've seen the greatest wave of forced removals in the city's history. And this is a city with a long and tragic history of forced removals. And the Olympic projects have been the justification for this. And it's happened under an authoritarian state and city government that have really made the most of the opportunity of the Olympics to implement their projects of their constituencies.
That was Sheena Roster reporting from Rio de Janeiro earlier this year. You're listening to the best of 2016 here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. In show 254, we turn the focus to Sydney, where a fight is brewing over an unusual social housing estate. The Sirius Building is a brutalist apartment complex that sits near the southern end of the Harbour Bridge. It was designed in the late 1970s to accommodate working-class families who were being displaced by gentrification in Sydney's oldest neighbourhood, The Rocks. From the day it opened, the building proved highly effective and became well known for its tight-knit community, bold design features and uninterrupted views of the Opera House. But over the past year, the future of the place has become rather uncertain. The New South Wales government recently announced plans to sell the Sirius Building and use the profits to construct more contemporary housing elsewhere in the city. To understand the impact of this decision, we sent Monocle's Adrian Craddock to investigate.
It's early evening in Sydney, and the city's waterfront is starting to hum with activity. Tourists and business people are spilling out of buildings and walking towards the ferry terminals at Circular Quay. Together they dodge seagulls and buskers and file onto large green boats, which will soon carry them across the harbour. As the vessels begin to move, some of the passengers gaze out of the windows. What they see looks almost like a postcard. The Opera House to the right, Luna Park straight ahead, and the Museum of Contemporary Art on the left. On this particular night, however, there is one thing about the view that seems slightly out of place. In the distance, near the south end of the Harbour Bridge, is a large brutalist building with a red sign flickering in one of its windows. The illuminated letters spell a message of desperation. They read S.O.S. For most people, the sign conjures up a list of questions. Namely, what is it and what does it mean? I wanted to find answers, so I recently paid a visit to an 89-year-old woman named Myra Dimitriou. Myra lives alone in the apartment that displays the sign. It's a small flat on the 10th floor of Sydney's most famous public housing project, the Sirius Building.
Nice to meet you. Thank you so much for having me in your home.
And I'm making a cup of coffee because there's water and cake there.
Designed by the architect Theo Gophers, the Sirius Building looks a little bit like a tower made out of mismatched Lego blocks. It was built in 1980 with a very specific purpose, to accommodate low-income families in Sydney's oldest neighbourhood, The Rocks. It was a refuge for those who were being displaced by gentrification in the area. The moment Myra arrived in 2008, she felt right at home. She particularly liked the storage in the bedroom.
All my clothes, all my Manchester sheets and towels, and I've even got all my suitcases in there.
Sadly for Myra, though, things have changed a bit recently. These days, there isn't much of a community in Sirius. It's just her and a handful of other tenants living in the building. That's because in 2014, the New South Wales government announced a plan to sell Sirius and began a process of moving everyone out. The decision had to do with the building's incredible waterfront location. The land that Sirius stands on is worth a lot, approximately $100 million Australian dollars. And for the state government, that kind of money has become too much to pass up. It could be used to construct a whole network of new public houses further out in the suburbs. Myra only remains in Sirius because the government hasn't found a suitable new home for her yet. She's watched the entire place empty out.
You don't see anybody anymore. You know, you'd come up in the lift and you'd see somebody all the time, or you'd see someone downstairs, but you don't see anybody now.
Myra says she's been frustrated by the change and doesn't really want to move. She's even joined a citizen group called Save Our Sirius, which is dedicated to protecting the building. They're the ones who came up with the idea of placing the flashing sign in her window.
The light spreads the news around to people, and I believe they can be seen, the SOS, which means Save Our Sirius. So we try to spread the word around what it's all about.
As I continue my travels around Sydney, it becomes clear that word has spread. The plan to sell Sirius off to private developers has caused a stir in the city. A number of high-profile architects have waded into the debate, including Sean Carter, the president of the Australian Institute of Architects New South Wales chapter. He says the building's futuristic exterior was a big part of what inspired him to become an architect in the first place.
You know, it's a bit like Madonna. You know, people either love it or they hate it. But you never not think anything of it. And I think that's actually quite an impressive trait of any form of architecture that can not just simply be a background building but moves people to feel something.
If you ask Sean, the building's rooftop gardens and communal areas are expertly designed. He sees Sirius as a shining example of how to do public housing right.
Provides them a compact way of living, so they have a low footprint where they can amortise their resources over the whole, over the collective. And it also gave them address in an important part of town where employment was probably high. So they had access to employment, they had access to services, they had access to health, they had amenity. All those things are what you need to make any housing project function really well.
What really concerns Sean isn't just the fact that the government wants to sell the apartment complex. It's that authorities have also ignored expert advice to have Sirius added to a list of protected heritage buildings. The New South Wales Heritage Council has even said that it believes the structure has great architectural and cultural worth. But the government has decided to not act on this recommendation. That means the complex will almost certainly end up being demolished.
You need to leave these little dots, these little markers in your city so that you can look back and you can tell your story. And we think Sirius is one of those particular examples. We're not asking for thousands of buildings to be saved, but one that's so significantly sewn into our storyline and into our architectural history.
Someone who echoes Sean's view is Tim Ross. He's a prominent Australian comedian who spends a lot of time studying mid-century architecture in Sydney. He recently staged a stand-up show on Sirius's ground floor, during which he explained why he loved the building.
It comes from a time where in Australia where we decided that we were going to look after people when it came to public housing. And so, yeah, they built things in that enabled people to meet in the places. On the 10th floor, there is a thing called the Heritage Room that's got amazing views that look over to the harbour. And that's there. It's another community meeting place where they could people could come and they could book it out, or they could have parties or small gatherings in there. So it was well designed in that way.
In the lead up to his show, Tim spent a bit of time with the building's remaining residents and learned what it was that made them feel so connected to Sirius. What he heard surprised him.
No one I've spoken to has spoken about the location as such, apart from it being the place they've always lived. They all say the one thing that you wouldn't expect, and that's they loved living here because of the community. And it fostered a fantastic community in this building, which I suppose ticks the boxes when it comes to its success as a piece of public housing.
It's a sentiment that rings particularly true for Myra. The building's million-dollar views have never really meant much to her. After all, she can't really appreciate them. She's legally blind.
It's no good to me because of my vision impairment. I said, I'm lucky to see the ship when it was in.
For now, Myra has to play the waiting game. The government hasn't shown any signs of reversing its decision, despite growing protests. But with such a great amount of public support, she does have hope. It's clear that there are plenty of people who are willing to fight for the building until the very end. Just ask Tim Ross.
I'll gladly chain myself to it when I get anywhere near the wrecking ball. And hopefully won't get to that, and I think there's enough people who love it and there's enough smart people around, and we'll fight it to the death.
That was Australian comedian Tim Ross finishing a report by Monocle's Adrian Craddock. In September, we marched our way to Russia to attend the Moscow Military Tattoo. This is one of the country's largest cultural festivals and attracts bands from across the world. This year, around 1,000 musicians were taking part, with 10 nights of concerts on Red Square. The event kicked off with a parade in Moscow's most Soviet of parks. Thomas Lowe went along to see the bands get their marching orders.
I knew how a military band parade in Moscow would turn out, full of pomp, circumstance and stern patriotism, the kind that stewed in Russia over the last few years. But I soon found out I was wrong. That's the Central Navy Band of Russia. Its conductor, Captain Alexei Karabanov, has a nicely tweaked moustache and a dozen medals pinned to the left-hand side of his uniform. It's not always easy in Russia to ask questions of the military, but in a mark of the mood here, he was more than happy to talk.
We're playing a number of marches today, some by Serbian and Russian composers. It's a festival. It's about meeting colleagues and old friends. There's always new friends too.
Several Russian military bands are here, including the well-known Presidential Orchestra, but it's the foreign contingent that's caught the eye of many who have come to watch.
You can see yourself, there's lots of people from different countries, and they're smiling. They're very open, and you can see how friendly they are. It makes you want to visit those countries and get to know the culture and study the language.
Normally we don't listen to this kind of music, but we have come because these kind of events are always interesting. I think it's important for our foreign guests too, to see how friendly and happy people are to see them.
About 2,000 people have turned out, and most are clearly having fun as they cheer and clap along the boulevard. The musicians, too, are in good spirits. Everyone does seem to be smiling, except perhaps for a poor Russian soldier with a sign introducing the Japanese band. He's stoically sticking to orders not to show a flicker of emotion.
Smile, smile, smile.
The Italian Carabinieri band are clearly the crowd favourite. They're relaxed before the march and joking with anyone who feels like a chat.
My name is Lieutenant Colonel Massimo Martinelli.
People seem to really like your band.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Because the Moscow people like Italian people, and there is a very close
relationship?
Yes, yes, relationships.
And how do you choose which songs you're going to play? Do you always have the same repertoire, or is it different songs particularly for Russia? Or?
Yes, yes, we have many clarinets and many saxophones, so less brass instruments. We have a sound, a particular sound, an Italian sound.
The Italians, along with the other bands, head straight down through Moscow's most Soviet park. Vedienha used to be the exposition center for the industry and agriculture of the whole of the USSR. The parade starts at a space rocket, then moves along the thoroughfare between grandiose pavilions dedicated to each of the former Soviet countries. If you look closely, you'll see the tops of the lampposts are shaped like sheaves of corn, a small symbol of the importance of agriculture in Soviet times. Most of these orchestras have already been to Moscow for this festival. For the Singapore band, however, it's a first, and its leader, Superintendent Amri Ben Amin, is a little taken aback.
This isn't what we expect of. Yeah, we thought it'll be cool, but look at the sun, it's shining. Yeah, and the group of musicians that's performed really impressed us. Yeah, the standard of music. What we did was that we fused some local music from the four ethnic races. We have Malay, Chinese, Indian, and Eurasian. And then we gel it together with some military and bagpipes. And you notice the bagpipe, yeah. So it's a long tradition from the British.
Is it just your band that mixes music and instruments and sounds like this? Or is it a very Singapore style?
No, it's not a Singapore style. It's
just you.
Yes, that's right. That's right. We always try for something different. And you can see the percussions, those ethnic percussions. Yeah, it's something different, which we thought people around Europe will appreciate it.
There's none of the security you'd normally see at a large event like this in Moscow. There aren't any metal detectors, and there's very few police. There aren't any barricades either, and many people get right up close to the action, surging forward to get photos and clips of the musicians as they march past. One of them, who's clearly having a great time, is euphonium player Nikos Karyanis with the Greek Navy and Air Force Band. He met his Russian wife during a show in Crimea 3 years ago.
Her mother was making the festival, and she was coming there to see the festival, and, you know, I asked her to dance with me there in the performance. We started speaking. You can see me, I'm very beautiful, because now you don't have camera, I need to say it. And it happened. I invited her in Greece, fell in love, and convinced her to move in Greece with me. And so, we are 1 year married.
So music in Russia can lead to love.
Music, it's making miracles.
And on this sweltering hot Moscow day, music has certainly worked a little bit of magic. For Monocle, in Moscow, I'm Thomas Lowe.
A report there by Thomas Lowe in Moscow. In South Africa, bikes are offering new opportunities in one of the poorest communities in the country. A cycle tour company has been set up to guide people around Johannesburg's oldest township, Alexandra, best known in the country for its miles of ramshackle huts, widespread poverty, and also, unfortunately, high levels of crime. So how do visitors respond, and can the business truly live up to the aim of improving the life of the residents? Our contributor Gavin Fisher donned his cycling shorts and his helmet, I hope, and went to find out.
For Jeffrey Malaudzi, the man behind the bike tours of Alexandra, his shed is not a place for odds and ends. Rather, it holds the culmination of many years' hard work for the 24-year-old.
So this is where we keep our bicycles.
Yeah.
This is our storage room. It's very small and beautiful as well. I grew up here, just the next street after. At the age of 15 years, I was arrested for housebreaking. We went into a house where we stole two bicycles. police came and we were arrested for that. But for me, it was an eye-opening to say that, you know, this is not the life that I'm going to be choosing for myself. I would love to choose something differently, which is exactly where we are now. Bapi is taking bicycles out so that you can adjust the bike in your seat or how you want your seat to be. From there, we are going to start our tour.
My name is Bapi. I'll be your tour guide. I was born here in this township. The theme of the tour, let's have fun and enjoy ourselves. Beep, 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 beep. These are our local taxis. Just calling customers. Don't get scared on the road. Let's just have fun. Where we are, Alexander, this was the first township that was found here in Johannesburg. Alexander was found in 1902. Alexander, it used to be a farm where, as you know, gold was found here in Johannesburg in 1818. Many people came from different provinces, different countries, to look for gold.
Once I mastered the art of cycling and wielding a microphone, I got a chance to look to my surroundings. The poverty is the first thing to hit you. There's the corrugated iron shacks, the shared outside toilets, the rubbish. But the air is laced with music, chatter, and the sickly sweet smells of food and people, which pulls your attention to the vibrant world alive around you. The tour embraces this by being pretty informal. We were encouraged to choose where to go and who to talk to, though we did still manage to end up cycling to a business owned by a friend of Papi's.
I'm Tobozo, guys. Welcome. You can come inside. What we basically do here is wash sneakers, right? All kinds of sneakers, even your one.
Surely not mine.
Trust me, man. We've found worse than this.
What do you think of the bike tours and people like us coming around?
I like this, man. I'd love to travel the world just you guys doing, you know? Mm. So, yeah, man, welcome, guys. Enjoy yourselves around here, you know?
One of the best descriptions of Alexandra came from Nelson Mandela, who said life in the township was exhilarating and precarious. The home where he lived is part of the tour, but it's soon forgotten, replaced by the far more interesting and spontaneous interactions and glimpses of life you get as you roll through.
Welcome.
And if glimpses aren't enough, then there was also the chance to look around the house of our guide, Papi.
I live all alone here, but other people in a space like this, there can be five of them, all six of them. Let me say, yeah, you will never go to bed on the hungry stomach here. Because we like to share many things.
There are still challenges and crime and...
We do have crime, but during the day, we are one big community. If someone will try to mug someone during the day, that's when you'll find people right now. They will chase him, and then they will catch you, so that everyone will give you a beating. So that the younger ones, they must know that, hey, if I'm trying to mug someone else, I will be beaten like this.
One of our last stops on the tour was to try some local food. So what are we eating?
We're going to eat kwata. Kwata. You will see. It's a surprise.
It also gave me the chance to chat to the only other person taking the tour with me, Patrick, on holiday in South Africa from Sweden.
Very interesting experience. Very special assault on your senses a bit, with urine, smell sometimes, and all the traffic and all the chaos, but pleasant surprises as well. Everyone is very nice. I haven't seen anyone begging, and it's a chaos, but everything seems to be working.
It seems clear that the tour is giving people an insight into what Alexandra is like, but is the community also gaining? Clearly the company are offering employment, but they've also managed to build a library with their proceeds and are providing bicycles for kids to get to school. But as the tour ended and we got back to the bike shed, I felt a niggling unease about rich, mostly white people riding around looking at poor, mostly black people. I asked Jeff if this worried him as well.
It does sometimes, but the whole purpose is to show people the development of this of the township. That is not going to be like this the whole time. You coming here, you don't know whose life you've changed.
You don't think any of them are thinking, ugh, those people riding through again?
Well, there's 1.1 million people living in Alexander, so you don't know what everyone thinks. Of course, like Mandela or Jesus itself, no one has ever pleased everyone. So there's some of those kind of people who will always say, ah, no. But of course, the majority is the most important part.
That was Gavin Fisher reporting from Johannesburg. As ever, 2016 was a year where we focused on the importance for green spaces in our cities. And perhaps more than anywhere else in the world, this is something that really applies to Singapore. As a city-state on a tightly packed piece of land, a special effort has been made to make sure the whole place just doesn't disappear under concrete. One organisation, the Nature Society of Singapore, has been protecting the city's green spaces and ensuring that wild Singapore isn't forgotten in the dash for modernity. But has it been successful? Well, Nicholas Walton met up with Margie Hall from the Society to find out.
Well, this is the Botanic Gardens, possibly the most famous green area in the whole of the city-state of Singapore, which in itself is one of the world's most crowded countries, crammed in as it is on this little island in Southeast Asia. You can probably hear all of the insects around us, and in the background you can actually see where we're standing, a six-lane highway, three lanes going either way. And I'm here with Margie Hall of the Nature Society in Singapore. Margie, what kind of benefit does it have to have such green spaces as the Botanic Gardens in a place as crowded as this?
An absolutely huge benefit, because the basic sort of city area and many of the residential areas where people are in high-rise apartments are very, very crowded indeed. And in fact, the apartment blocks are going up higher and higher, so that the government now is building up to 45 stories for some of the so-called public housing. But it means that there are a huge number of people who need space to breathe and some recreational space. And so if you don't have enough of that recreational space, people are going to really feel hemmed in. And even more than recreational space, you still need space for the natural biodiversity of Singapore.
Now, that is something that I've always been surprised at in Singapore. You come to the Botanic Gardens, right smack bang in the middle of the town, and you see these enormous monitor lizards, you see squirrels in the trees, I've seen snakes here, all sorts of things. So the biodiversity of Singapore is still there, despite it being so crowded.
Some of it's there. Obviously, it's the animals that could cope with the type of greenery that's mostly available that you see. So it's a bit like urban foxes in London. The water monitors are tough omnivores, they can survive anywhere. So you see these big lizards all around.
About a metre long?
Oh, up to 2.5 metres in some places, yes. And the squirrels that you see around, the plantain squirrels, those are the hardy ones. But there is a lot of other biodiversity that's already gone extinct. There are cream-coloured flying squirrel is no longer here. The slender squirrels will only be in the really forested areas. A lot of the big forest birds have long since all become extinct.
Take us away from where we are now in the Botanic Gardens, because this is well recognised. It's a UNESCO heritage site, etc. What else is there in terms of greenery in Singapore?
Well, in terms of the city area, there's also a large area at Fort Canning Park, which is the hill nearest the Singapore River. And there's the new Gardens by the Bay, which is not very green yet. It's on the reclaimed land in the new city centre in the south. But apart from that, you have got probably three sorts of greenery. You've got parks built in residential areas, bigger and smaller ones, essentially recreational parks. Then you've got park connectors, which are usages of spare spaces alongside canals and rivers, which link up parks one to another and also provide routes sort of round the back of housing development areas and things like that. And then thirdly, you've got the nature reserves themselves, which are really a few primary forest patches, but a lot of it fairly mature secondary forest all around the four central reservoirs. And then you've got a small nature reserve down by the coast. And in the north, you've got Sungai Buloh Wetland Reserve, which is basically mangroves.
What's the point of all of this, in your view? I mean, obviously, in a place like this, you have people coming for a nice walk, or sit down on a bench. They look at the turtles in the ponds. They come here with their kids. My own son learned how to walk on these slopes here, which was great for him, and it's a beautiful place. But is there anything more to it than just leisure activities? When you've got something as crowded as Singapore, can they afford it to do more than that?
Yes, they can afford nature reserves, and they can afford public spaces. One is that particularly the green public spaces in near the city area and all the landscaping that's gone on is a deliberate, economically based move to to brand Singapore as a clean green city, a garden city, and now the latest, a city in a garden, in order to attract foreign investors. Because it was recognized that foreign investors don't just come with a factory, they've actually got personnel who want to live here, and management personnel will not want to move to Singapore if it's not an attractive place to live. So you go back, you find Lee Kuan Yew stating that the reason, one of the big reasons for landscaping the city of Singapore and having a number of park spaces was precisely an economic one. And there's a strong political reason, because you've got to provide some sort of recreational space or green space for an urban population.
Do you think that Singaporeans living in such a densely urban area, you know, quite limited despite all of the land reclamation that's gone on in the sea, do you think that they've lost a bit of touch with nature?
Oh yeah, they've definitely lost touch with nature. It is very typical of people who grow up now in high-rise apartments where everything is kept very clean and mothers are worried about germs and everything, that if you take out groups of school children for educational trips in nature areas, that they've practically refuse to touch anything. It's all, so dirty one, That recoil from natural things is a problem.
That was Margie Hall of the Nature Society of Singapore, and she was speaking to Nicholas Walton. And as you could hear, they were surrounded by some rather friendly crickets and cicadas. That's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. Remember that you can find out more about all of our shows at monocle.com, SoundCloud, or on our free Monocle 24 app. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by Yulene Goffin and edited by Weidong Lin. To play you out this episode of The Urbanist, we've got Pat Benatar with Hit Me With Your Best Shot. But before we play that, we'd just like to say Happy New Year and hope 2017 is going to be great for you and whatever city you live in. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.